CliffCentral.com.
That's right, CliffCentral.com on a Wednesday morning. It's almost the end of April. I mean, Saturday is the 1st of May, and then we're pretty much in proper solid winter. Gord Laws is with us this morning, and Sia Sangweni. It's going to be a fun day, and I hope you're going to squeeze in. It's going to be May. Yes, that's right. Very good. That's exactly right.
Who is it? Backstreet Boys?
In sync. Justin
Timberlake. Yeah. It never stops being funny, that one.
It's going to be May. That's beautiful. All right. Dude, it's so ridiculous. So I was sitting with the family. We had a family lunch yesterday, and I know this is a four-day week, so we've all got to squeeze in much more work. You know, it's funny. You think you get the extra day off in the middle of the week like we had yesterday. You think, oh, well, that's great. We're only going to have 3 days now of work, but it seems like this week I'm squeezing in 5 or 6 days of work into four because I was at the office on Monday. I'm going in today, sorting out some stuff tomorrow, going in again on Friday. So it's going to be crazy busy. It's almost back to like pre-COVID levels of activity, which is fantastic. I'm not complaining about it. But I was sitting with a family yesterday, and we were talking about how, you know, with all of this this change that's happened and people working from home and all the rest, you know, how little traveling we all do. And we're out of practice with our cars. I think people are, because I see accidents all the time. The last week, there were two monstrous accidents on the N1 between Pretoria and Johannesburg. Yeah, really bad. I mean, like traffic on Friday last week was an absolute clusterfuck. There was just no way. Did you see what was happening? I mean, were you speaking to anybody who was driving around on Friday? Because my God, no. It was a mess. Friday and on Wednesday, apparently, there was also some disaster.
One.
Gord, your internet's just gone off on the, I don't know what's happened to it. It's gone crazy.
Oh, made fun of Elon Musk. Look at what's happening now.
No, Gord, I'm taking you off quickly. Sort that out. Come back in. We don't know what's happened. Gord, we're losing you. Try again. Come back again. Gord Laws.
So your theory is people don't know how to drive anymore since they haven't in so long.
I'm telling you, it's because we're out of practice. Like, people aren't driving properly. Let me see if Gord's... Ah, there he is. Hello, Gordo.
Working now.
Yeah, it seems to be working. I don't know. Your internet went on the blank.
Am I back?
Yeah, you're back. Back again. Gordon's back. Tell your friends. So did you hear about these accidents? Because I'm telling you, it's because people are out of practice with driving.
Did you notice that there was, like, obviously because of the hectic restrictions and people slowly but surely having to kind of get used to it, there was a lot less traffic for a few months, and it's sort of slowly but surely gone back to like normal traffic. But I noticed that when the traffic was a quarter of what it normally is, the government turned all the robots off. And now that the traffic is I swear to God, and now that the traffic is back to traffic, there's not robots off all the time. One or two here and there like normal, but they didn't switch all of it off for the northern suburbs. It's like, the traffic's going to flow freely and people will not be furious and hate their life. Let's not only not upgrade the roads, let's turn the traffic lights off. But I noticed, like, because I've been rollerblading, as we mentioned in the first half of the show, and I'm driving to Rivonia for it like four or five times last week, and drunk drivers, hammered drivers are out late at night on weeknights.
Yeah.
And I know Rivonia has become a bit of a shithole and it's known for its sketchy jaws.
Hey, careful. Like, that's our neighborhood. That's where our offices are.
Yeah, that's where I grew up, dude. Where I grew up, in Rivonia, on Bevan.
Now
Road.
It's become, I mean, like, it's first of all, it's the place where all the strippers are, because there are more strip clubs. There are more strip clubs in Rivonia than anything else. And there's a lot of, like, Chinese shops, which I always think are basically money laundering facilities, because they never sell anything, and yet they're always running, selling like cheap shit to one or two people a month. It's ridiculous.
But the thing about it is it's not a problem that it's now become a jaw location after being like a sleepy suburban sort of grocery shopping center for the neighborhood. It's what's become of my childhood area. It's cool. People jaw there.
Sure.
But many of them are jawing there on a Monday night at 8 p.m. hammered on a Monday. It used to be for me that like bars and restaurants were.
Do you think that? I mean, I've never been able to have a party on a Sunday. I've never been able to do anything on a Sunday. By lunchtime on a Sunday, no. I don't want to do anything except I have an afternoon nap. And this is when I was 16, when I was 20, when I was 25, when I was 30. I've never wanted to jol on a Sunday. I never understood that. And there are some people in South Africa where their biggest party day of the week is the Sunday.
Dude. Even the Thursday yep. thing, like I understood it when there was a time when I was in my early 20s to about my mid, so from like 22 to about 26 or 7, when I used to play a drum and bass residency in Melville every Tuesday night. And to my eternal shame, like fully to my actual eternal shame, I used to drive home all the way back to Rivonia hammered once a week, sleep for 3 hours, no drugs, but plenty of drinking, sleep for 3 hours, go to work. And I'd be like, wow, guys, I've got such a hangover. I better go eat a toasted cheese and bacon and I'll feel fine. And then at 10 p.m., you're like, at 10 a.m., you're like, wow, guys, that was a bad hangover. But I literally cannot. I've got to know that if I'm going to jol on a school night, even a little bit, even drink 3 glasses of wine with dinner, I can't work the next day. I get hangovers to the point where it's like I often think I should call a doctor.
Yeah.
It's like alcohol poisons me to some extent. Aside from the obvious, you know, you're getting drunk and intoxicated, all of that. It has like a – I don't know anyone who gets hangovers like me. And I've had much worse hangovers than my friends. When we were kids and they had no hangover, I had some little hangover. When they got a little baby hangover, I was getting grown-up hangovers and so forth.
I used to be fine. Like in my 20s, even into halfway through my
30s. Dude, I was with you for some of that.
I used to hit it hard. I mean, I would be drinking tons and tons and tons of tequila. Literally,
I'm not surprised you don't remember, but I was with you.
No, I know you. Well, you were for some of them, and I've
seen
up,
you. I've seen you clap it. Is my point.
I'd wake up the next day and I'd be okay. I'd be fine. I'd be able to go to work. In fact, I used to do the morning show some mornings when I was. I'm sure I was still drunk, not even hungover. And then somewhere in my 30s, it all like came home to roost, and I just realized like this is not something I can do anymore. So now. I can do maximum one night a week of, you know, being with people and drinking and carrying on. If I do two, it spoils my whole weekend. I my recovery time is so long and so arduous, so horrible. I mean, I have to keep Miprodols in my house in case that ever happens. And then I'll
straight up.
I have to hit them hard, man. I mean, it's just,
I gotta have the curtains closed.
Never used to be like that. It never used to be. Sia's laughing at us. He thinks this is hilarious, but one day it'll come and roost in your
it's
house.
Coming for it's you. Coming. No,
it does happen to me as well, and you just have to monitor it. But in thinking of the Johannesburg context, you can go out and party and club on any day of the week.
That's true.
I'm thinking now of any day you can find something. Sundays are
you can definitely go get loose in Rivonia on a Monday.
Look, there's something called Mukhodu Mondays now that you party your face off if you go to Mukhodu Mondays.
So if you see someone with no face on work at a Tuesday, it's Mukhodu Mondays.
Mukhodu
Mondays. I often see people just Mukhodu.
You know what
Mukhodu
is? You know what Mukhodu is, Gord? It's a sheep's head.
Oh.
Yeah. It's like, you know.
It started out very innocently.
Yeah, Mukhodu is like a meal. Like a meal that some people eat. You basically cook the
I've
whole sheep's
head. I've seen the sheep
heads.
I just didn't know they were called.
Mukhodu.
Yeah, and usually it's cut in half.
Yeah, Barbalicious on a. What is
so it's a metaphor for cut half your face off at this jaw.
Yeah, well, I suppose it is the best metaphor for it because sometimes I feel like my brain's been sawed in half when I wake up with one of those hangovers. It hasn't happened for a little while, thank God, but, yo, man, horrible.
Part of me wishes I could get away with it like I used to, and part of me is glad that there's this consequence that makes it like something I'm hesitant to do.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't drank for like a year and a half almost, but it's just out of I just was over it. And yeah, I had a big December 2019, 2020. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to do that like dry January thing. And maybe February, we'll see how it goes. And then I had a.
You just explained like when you're lying in bed with a hangover the next morning that you actually shake and you have to close all the curtains. I mean, what other precautions do you take?
I cannot go to work. I mean, I cannot go to work. I couldn't go to work with a hangover and not be like an oak who looks like he's devastated from a hangover and starts swearing at everyone and cries at my desk.
Is there anything you can do to mitigate these feelings or to mitigate this pain?
nothing I'm prepared to talk about on the radio.
Wait, I'm thinking of everything that you've spoken to us about before. And how this is now something that you can't speak about. So what does that mean? What level of illegal business is this?
Snai is correcting us here. It's actually tripe, Mohodu. But then what is...
Okay.
What is the sheep's head called? Is that also included under that category? Cabello's also
I know it as a smiley, but I hope that's not like some derogatory shit that's trapped in my self-conscious from childhood. I don't know if it's meant to be called that, but that's what I know it as.
Okay, well, Cabello and Snai, if you can help us with like what the sheep's head is, because I know there's a
half sheep head sliced front ways.
Yeah. Not see as
So there's nothing I can do. I've just got to have the day. I need at least one day. And another thing that I notice as well, and I've read this in a few places, and it varies from 5 to 7 or 8, but they say that the actual effects of drinking, of heavy drinking, stay with your body for 7 days. So you don't know. You think you wrecked hungover the next day and you're a bit grumpy at work on Monday, and then you kind of normal Tuesday, Wednesday, and you like miraculously feel way more positive about life on Thursday. And then on Friday, you chipper as shit and you're like, life's great. Let's go Joel. But you don't realize that like life hasn't felt great today and yesterday. It's just gone back to feeling all right because you felt like shit all week. And I'm not judging, like people must do what they want. I've done plenty of this, and I'll probably jaw my face off at some point again, almost certainly at some stage I'll jaw my face off. But you just got to understand, it's not like if you jaw on Saturday you feel min on Sunday. You feel like you almost okay on Monday, but your brain is not you're pissy and irritable and tired and foggy headed and fuck my colleagues and all that stuff. Might be because you got molded on the weekend.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I mean, there's no reason that it would just immediately all evacuate your system in 24 hours. It makes perfect sense. It stays.
No, just because the mad headache and because the like immediate obvious symptoms are gone. So yeah, drink as long as you don't drive or injure or hurt anybody, drink as much as you want. I'm not in a place of telling people what to do. I'm just like, that's a thing you should know.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you on
that. Well, then somehow we still do this to ourselves though, because we'll forget all of this and drink again over the weekend. But I was surprised to find out a few days ago, someone close to me had booked themselves into a rehab because of alcohol. And
good for them.
I wouldn't say there's still necessarily a stigma, but I was shocked to go, from alcohol?
Yeah.
And you felt like
I hope they come out and they turn their life around 100% and they make a shining example. And all of you and your friends that know him or her can be like, yeah, that person went to rehab and look how brilliantly they're doing now. Go to rehab if you're not handling whatever it is. Go see someone.
We in this country take drugs way more seriously than we take alcohol. And actually, in many situations and circumstances, alcohol is a lot more dangerous and a lot worse. And people make much worse decisions based on them being drunk than on them being high. And you know that I'm not a massive I'm so naive about drugs, and I have been most of my life. But I'll tell you this: like, I would rather have people smoking weed all over South Africa, and I don't like the smell of it. I don't smoke it, but I have no problem with it at all. Than drinking as much as we do. We have such a drinking culture in South Africa. That's the only way.
It makes me aggressive on the show and highly inclined to fight and maybe beat up a family member.
You've been very aggro on the show with your joints. No,
I haven't got kids around me because the weed, I'd beat the shit out of them.
Of course. No, you're such an aggro guy.
Oh, gosh.
We do have a problem, though, in South Africa. I mean, aren't we ranked somewhere in the top 5 of the countries of the most binge drinking? I think we are.
I don't know, but it's look, I mean, I can't be judged. I just want to throw the disclaimer out every time. I'm not judging. I've done all of these things more than anyone probably ever should. But I just think being aware of what you're actually doing to yourself is important. It's the same with food. I'm not like, now I've lost 1 million kilos on keto. Everyone must be keto. If you're not particularly carb sensitive, eat what you want. Just understand that like when you drink a beer, you're not like, I'm thirsty, this will solve the problem. Or when you smoke a cigarette, you're like, this is a better way to get air. When you eat garbage food, it's just some fun you're having with your chewing and swallowing system. Same with the booze thing. It's fun, but it's not just the hangover. You're not better when the hangover's gone.
Here's Carl boasting about, he's 36. He had 3 triple whiskeys last night, and he's a gym now. Well, okay, Carl.
You get people like that. I know a lady that I didn't see her. We went on like two dates and nothing happened. But a lady that I went on two dates with a couple of years ago, she was saying how she like starts drinking wine every day at 4, drinks 2-3 bottles. And that's why she was a little bit on the like whiny side by dinner time. It wasn't her first drink. And she was like, I never get hangovers. I've never had one in my life. And I drink wine every day from about 4 o'clock. It's the best. And I'm like, and she's older than me. I'm like, fuck's sake. Okay. If I drank 3 glasses of wine with dinner and went to bed 3 hours later, I'd wake up feeling like shit in the morning.
Sinister Cabal says, the rat and parrot in Grahamstown looks like a Friday night every night of the week. Those rodents can drink. Yeah, that place is just – didn't Rhodes also break the record for the campus that had the most – they bought and drank the most beer in a season? I can't remember what it was.
Something but like there was some, Patel.
Yeah, there was some story about how they just – immediately heard like some university in Texas or whatever had beaten them, and they were like, screw you, and they all got out in their drinking shoes and they went out and they broke the record themselves and got it back. Just to correct the sheep's head, apparently it is, according to Cabello, it's a smiley or scop. And then Michael says, apparently in the bush, mojado is a cow's head, which is boiled and then smashed to bits. It smells horrible and is sticky and horrible. Okay. And then, I don't know. It's horrible.
We talk about drinking so much. Do you guys know people who have gone to rehab, or am I just naive?
Plenty for drinking and drugs. Lots.
Whoa.
I wouldn't be able to count off the top of my head, but at least a dozen, maybe two.
Sure. Okay. I don't know.
It was interesting. I had a bit of a chip on my shoulder, and I was like, yeah, you know what? You better thank us for our service. Part of this person's wake-up call was listening to Sam Cowan on this show speak about her journey with alcoholism. And then he had a bit of a realization like, oh, wait, I have a bit of...
That's my problem too, right? Yeah.
Ooh,
well, I don't know.
It just happened.
I'll tell you something though, that there was a friend of mine a while ago who I asked him about this. He never admitted it or didn't, but he said he told us that he had some kind of kidney or liver problem, and he didn't really. He was just saying it because he wanted to stop drinking and he didn't know how to tell us he wanted to stop drinking. So I said to him, look, you could just say no, you know.
Well, a big thing as well is that like we live in quite isolated little communities where you only out when you're not in the complex or whatever, and you're driving to the office, and hopefully that stops being a thing forever. And like, you know, you've got to create social activities. Either you can embrace nature if you live in Cape Town, put on a 4-centimeter wetsuit and go out in that water, or hike the mountain at 5 a.m. And that's great for people who are into that. But if you're not into going out into the Magaliesberg and hiking to a natural spring, there's really nothing to do except for, like Sia says, millions of Jol options every day of the week. So it's like it's hard. I know, as a person not drinking, and also under COVID when no one was drinking, and with those restrictions or whatever, it's hard enough when it's not even COVID to get a bunch of your mates together to hang and be jovial when they've got shit to do. But if you throw "and we'll be drinking" in, they're like, oh, great. Well, then I'll come drink with you guys. So it's difficult for me. Not difficult. I do fine, but it's harder to meet new people. See, this is also why drinking helps, because in a socially uninhibited environment, you meet your friends' friends. So you've got this connector between you and new people,
right?
Mutual friends sit at the same table, meet them.
Yeah.
And that's hard. It's easy to, well, not easy, but with a bit of work, it's easy enough to stay in touch with people you already know, but then you end up with randoms on the internet. And I hate nothing more than a DM girlfriend, a person who's only in an app.
I'm trying to arrange. One of my mates said to me over the weekend, let's do like a weekend away and get a nice crew together. You know, book one of these places in, I don't know, the Midlands or Dalstrom or somewhere where it's nice. And, you know, in winter, it'll be good to make fires and all that kind of thing. And you sit around and talk shit and all that stuff. And it's a good idea. But now we're at the point where we have to decide who we're going to invite along. It's not so easy. Because
now anyone you don't invite along is going to know.
Yeah,
you go on your trip.
But also the ones you do invite. This is where it's complicated. So he's single, I'm single. So what we're thinking is we'll invite, one or two of the people who we know are also single, but there might be a couple that we invite along as well. Then it sort of shifts the dynamics. Then there might be some single girl who comes along, but she might be really complicated. So we've actually got to be very careful about who we bring along, because otherwise it could spoil the whole dynamic, and then you end up with people with drama the whole fucking weekend, and no one wants that.
And someone who's like got a major political thing that's all they'll talk about, and you get made part of the problem just for not having to wanting to have the conversation.
Correct. So you're trying to plan like a fun weekend, unless you know those people well. In other words, unless they're the same friends that you see reasonably often, you're going to end up with drama, and there's going to be people who are just not meant to be there. I don't know how to solve this problem. We're going to have to like draw up a list and then cross people off. Suppose that's the only way to do it.
End up being out in the wilderness by yourself. Let's just have a braai at my house.
Yeah, let's just have a braai at my house. Screw this. It's boring now. Oh, man, it's difficult. And it's not because it's not for lack of friends. I mean, I love all of my friends, but there's some of them that are like oil and water. Some just don't go well together.
Yeah, I've also got groups of friends that just wouldn't understand each other. Tracy Bard says, we rank behind the Russians on the drinkometer, and I can believe that. The Russians have got to be up there. We're up there. The Australians definitely can binge drink in the Olympics and always have a podium chance. Russians for sure, and East Europeans in general. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really, who doesn't have a culture of hard drinking? The cultures just differ from place to place, but hard drinking. I mean, the English have got a serious binge drinking problem with the youth. They get hammered into hospital all the time. But I think the Russians are, I mean, unless it's all stereotyping, right? It might just be like, you know, Western portrayal of Russians, but they tend to have a half jack of vodka at all times.
The Russians make.
And I've got some East European friends who reckon that's not too far off.
No, they make their own liquor as well. I mean, we've talked about this on the show before. In fact, we've had a couple of Russians come on and testify to this, is that they would actually brew their own stuff, this dangerous shit, like they make out of diesel fuel and, you know, they cook it in the back garden.
Like a fermenter car battery
car batteries, and then they put in like lizards and all kinds of other shit, and then it starts to rot and ferment, and then the alcohol content.
Blood of a British royal, all that mystical shit.
And they then cook it up in the garden for
one of Gareth's rabbits.
10 years, and then they pull it out and they go, oh, this is very nice. This is good stuff. We drink this.
They take it to Chernobyl and bury it in the ground for 6 years.
But my dad was telling me about how when they were farming, like when he was a kid, they used to have all the farm workers, and they would also make their own stuff in these barrels. They would take like a, you know, those drums that you used to put fuel
That's
in?
Like Mampur.
Yeah, but not like Mampur. It's like, it's called something else. I can't remember the name now. But he told me that the workers on the farm, they would make this stuff.
Witblitz? Is Witblitz
No. This was not properly distilled alcohol. This was like the potions we're talking about with respect to the Russians. It's like they'd put fucking everything in there, batteries, all kinds of crap. And then it would make this really potent stuff that was just, it would basically, like one sip of it would completely fuck you up. You would be unable to do anything. And they would get so blind drunk that people would pick up like axes and like lodge them in other people's heads and shit. And it was just chaos.
So that sounds like
the Russians. The Russians take everything to the nth degree.
Yeah.
They like created some ultra cheap, ultra nasty amphetamine called Crocodile. And it was like meth, but it was like you gave your meth and then took your meth that was on meth. And they just like start biting their own lips off and eating their own arms and their body parts start to rot. Mm. And that's why it's called Crocodile as well. You get these scales on your wounds, and it's like giving yourself the final stages of leprosy on purpose, so that you can get much more fucked than meth and much more cheaply.
I'll tell you what, there are people who are looking, people are looking for highs, man. People are looking for excitement. It's just, it's frightening with what depths and lengths they'll go to discover the new kind of excitement, the new high. It's madness.
Snaya Zulu says, I speak like Cartman from South Park. I don't think that I do. I think I laugh like Muttley.
You do like laugh like Muttley. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Tracy says,
I sing to my cat like Cartman.
Didn't you have a bacon cocktail in the U.S. a few years ago? I did. That was when I went to Texas. And it's just a cocktail. It's like a normal cocktail, but they've got a strip of bacon in as a garnish. So
no,
I know it was gross.
It's not necessary,
but you have to. That's immersing yourself in the culture, right?
Yeah, immersing yourself in American culture. To immerse yourself in American culture, you'd have to eat 18 hamburgers, then shoot yourself by accident with a handgun, and then shame yourself on the internet about it.
Well, that could also be a Russian culture.
And then insist on your own right to have a handgun and shoot yourself with it.
Well, listen to this. Andre says, Russian minks are becoming extinct, so the poor Russians have to drink throughout the day just to keep warm. But Russians themselves are becoming extinct. They've got a very...
I think Russians are aware of synthetic fabric by now.
Definitely.
Yeah, I mean, they can make nuclear warheads and put people in space. They could probably figure out that you don't have to kill a mink or freeze to death every year.
Have you guys seen that YouTube video of the Russian colony on Mars? It is hysterical. I can't play it now on the show because it's too long to play. But I'll post the link. I'll send it to Sia and he can put it on the website. It's really, really funny. Someone sent it to me the other day. Just these... like these crazy Russians and all the things that they would do if they were colonizing Mars. It's so hilarious. You'll love it. And how they're trying to recruit people to come and help them on their Russian Mars farm.
But in seriousness, in terms of like people that drink hard to the point where keeping up with them can be fatal. Mm. I remember I was at this exact particular Joel with you, Gareth, after the Coca-Cola 2006 Metallica thing, mm-hmm. In Durban, mm-hmm. we had a big after party at a hotel.
Yes, absolutely.
And my dear friend and Bootfighter partner, Louis Dupasani, who's a big Afrikaans man, he doesn't drink now, but he used to be able to drink hard and he's big. And, then there was the singer Lowry from the Rasmus, the smallest person on the tour, 5 foot singer of Norwegian band the Rasmus, mm-hmm. who Lars Ulrich told me means a loud noise or a racket. And he had like feathers in his hair and he was super cool, but he had like an effeminate, like sort of earth child vibe going. And he literally drank Louis, the champion of Afrikaans drinkers. And then Louis is really, I can drink back in the day, as you've seen, and he could drink as much as me. And he ended up underneath, literally physically underneath the table. And I had to help him from being drank under the table by a little Finnish man or Norwegian man who weighs the third what he does. The dude just never fell down. He just carried on drinking. And when Louis was finished and I took him to the car, I came back and he was like, Rad, are we going to jol some more? What's the next step? I'm like, you should be dead. My friend is almost dead and he's got three times as much blood in his body as you. How are you not dead?
The funny thing, first of all, I'm so glad you remember that night because it was such a special evening. I mean, we were up close and personal and talking to the dudes from
Zanya was there.
Yeah. This friend of mine, Zanya, she and I still joke about that night.
You seem to hit it off well with the blonde oak from Collective Soul.
Yeah. We ended up like swapping phone numbers. Ed Roland, and he said to me, dude, if you're ever in if you're ever in Atlanta, because he lives in Atlanta in Georgia, he's like, you better let me know. I mean, of course, I'm not going to call up some dude who's a famous rock musician and stay at his house. But he was like, anytime you want to come through. And he also hit it off well with my friend Zanya. They got on very well that night. That's all I'll say.
I remember that. Yeah. I remember that as well. That was a proper
thing. Yeah, she has.
And when you phone him and be like, dude, I'm coming to Atlanta, where should I meet you? And he'll be like, where the river flows.
So the funny thing about that night is, I mean, I was actually talking to like Lars Ulrich. I couldn't believe what was happening.
Yeah, man. I got kicked out of Opium Nightclub in Cape Town with Lars.
Can I tell you what happened that made that whole party take place? Because this is hilarious. And then we'll get to Sean Saunders. I want to get an update from him because we're back in the money on Bitcoin. But we'll talk about that in a second. This is hilarious. So at that point, the concert, it was called the Coca-Cola Coke Fest. It was so funny. Worst name for it. Anyway. Metallica were there and the Rasmus, and there were a whole bunch of other people too. Collective Soul,
Simple Plan.
It was
Moby.
such a great concert. And, you know, Durban, unfortunately, you know.
No, Fatboy Slim.
Nobody ever comes to concerts in Durban in the numbers that they should.
Ever.
So this is why Durban never gets good shows, because they don't support them.
And then complains that when bands come out, they go everywhere except Durban.
So the guy from Big Concerts, who's a friend of mine, called me and said, listen, dude, all the guys who were on stage just now, all of them, literally all these huge rock stars, they want to have a party, but we don't know where to go because it's a public holiday today and most people are going to work tomorrow, so there's probably nothing happening. So I'm like, well, I don't know what I can do, but maybe we take it back to the hotel that everybody's staying at, because then they can, you know, just go to sleep afterwards. and we'll open it up. So I arrived at the hotel. I don't know how I got there as fast as I did. And I said to the night manager, I said, you open that bar now. And I had been given a budget by them. So I could spend, you know, X amount of money. It was quite a lot of money. I was like, let's do this. I said, I phoned every girl I knew in Durban. And I was like, you need to get down to the hotel now and just make it look like a fucking party's going on. They all pulled in.
It was a party when I got there, dude. And we came straight from the show.
I made that happen. So I said, open up the bar, put bottles of this everywhere. Make sure there's music. Make sure there's lights.
One of my best friends.
We were playing music off of my iPhone or my iPod or whatever it was at the time, because there was just nothing else going on. And the hotel was dead when I arrived there. There was no one sitting in reception. There was nothing happening. And I had half an hour to get it ready for all these people to arrive. And, you know, you don't want to put on a show for Metallica, for God's sake, or Collective Soul, or, you know, these are famous, important people who've provided everyone else in the world with entertainment. And I'm like, we can't make Durban boring and shit for them. So we turned it up.
I can attest that you succeeded, dude. Yeah. And I remember when I got there chatting with you, and I also remember there was just a row of drinks on the bar, and I thought someone had ordered like 30 shooters, and there was someone going to come and have them with their 10 friends.
That was me.
And you were like, no, those are just shooters. Have one. Okay, dude, yeah. I'm in.
No. So we made a party.
That poor hotel, dude. That poor, poor hotel. I know just the outside area where we were. Not that we were being kids and breaking stuff or whatever, but there was just mayhem.
No, it was chaos.
People.
And
chaos.
I am very proud that we managed to make it happen, because the next day at the airport, I saw a couple of guys from the band, and they were like, hey, man, how are you even alive? And I was like, yeah, this is how we do it here. We don't mess around.
Also, like James wasn't involved. He wouldn't stick around. He would leave and go back to the hotel with his wife. But the other three, James, Kirk, and Rob, Lars, Kirk, and Rob.
Yeah.
Lars, for all of his reputation of being a rock star in the 90s, isn't he the nicest dude
Such
in the world?
Guy.
In the whole world.
And I was just pleased
Fun,
because
nice, interested
I know,
in you.
I know they're your favorite band, and you got to, that was one of the occasions you got to meet with them and talk to them properly, like
yeah, a
human beings.
Got thrown out of a so nightclub great. With Lars, but that's, we got to get to the handsomest, I mean, to Sean, and we'll just ask Lars. I kicked out of.
All right. Well, enough of us reminiscing about when we used to behave badly with actual
And we used to be cool
stars.
And do cool things with cool people, yeah.
All right, let's get into it, because Sean Saunders is here. It's always good to see Sean and for him to give us an update on what's going on in the world of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. So, Sean, first of all, how are you, and how's your like broken up week been? Did you do anything fun yesterday?
No, unfortunately, I worked. So, yeah, just another day, I suppose. There's no public holiday in the UK.
And there's no public holiday for Bitcoin. I mean, this is the funny thing, right? It's like stock markets and stock exchanges. They open and close. But Bitcoin is always up for sale and always up for purchase.
Yeah, I think that's one of the interesting things with the crypto market, right? It's 24/7, 365.
Yeah.
It never turns off. It's kind of weird when you actually start dealing with exchanges. I mean, my past life, I was naturally working on a trading floor. Mm-hmm. I worked as an investment banker. And to have, to go back to it now, and like I liquidated some of my, one of the stock positions that I have. And to have to wait 2 days, you know, the clearing and settlement side of things.
When did you do that?
2 days.
When did you do that? Last week?
Yes, the day before yesterday.
So I did the same thing. I actually went and I said it on the show on Monday. I don't have a huge number of stocks and shares, but I sold a whole bunch of Google and Apple and, you know, some U.S. positions that I had, because Joe Biden's about to introduce this new capital gains tax, and there's a whole lot of other stuff that's going to affect business negatively. So I saw the headlines. I decided to sell all of those and buy Bitcoin. And I bought the Bitcoin at $48,000, which is exactly when it was at its lowest and it turned around. And now it's at $54,000. It was at $55,000 briefly this morning too. So already I've made more money on that than I did off any of those companies' shares.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Yeah, I mean, it was a wild ride in crypto this week. I mean, you really saw a big pullback. When was it, about last week, Tuesday, Wednesday?
Right.
And things came roaring back. I mean, Tesla came out yesterday. I think this is the big news of the week, really.
Yeah.
Is that Tesla came out yesterday saying that
they made 110 million on Bitcoin alone, right? I mean, they didn't have to sell a single car. Yeah.
100%. They made more because, you know, the Tesla also sells their, it's like a carbon credits equivalent.
Yeah.
Essentially, they're selling their green energy to other automakers and whatnot, and in the form of like tax credits.
Mm-hmm.
And they made more money selling those tax credits and Bitcoin than they did producing cars. Absolutely insane.
Mad.
I mean, $101 million to be exact. I mean, that's an incredible amount of money that Tesla made. And apparently, Elon came out to say that they sold 10% because they wanted to prove or demonstrate that Bitcoin's liquid and it can actually be treated similar to a US dollar. So I think that sent quite a few other companies really moving into the crypto space. And that's sort of what's driven this really big gain over the last week.
Yeah, I'm very excited about this. How are the rest of them doing? I mean, is Ethereum also up nicely?
Ethereum's actually had a phenomenal week. So it went through a Berlin, it's called a Berlin upgrade. I mean, they come up with these interesting names every quarter or so for new upgrades, because again, all of these are sort of like operating systems, right? So if you think about Windows 95 and then you went to Vista, I mean, I'm sure there was a few different operating systems before then, but each operating system is essentially an upgrade. And Ethereum went through a recent upgrade in terms of improving its scalability and all the rest. They call this, there was the Berlin upgrade, there was the London upgrade. I mean, there's a few others on the way. And that actually went ahead relatively well. So, I mean, Ethereum's up about 14%. Overall, I think the crypto market's pretty flat over the week, because remember, it was this time last week that it took a really big dive.
Yeah, that's right.
But I mean, if you're looking at the year-over-year returns, it's just insane. I mean, again, like the growth of this market is back over, you know, the entire market's worth over $2 trillion. It's, again, competing with Apple in terms of how valuable the entire market is. And I think if you're looking at now, I guess we've always been speaking about the retail investors that enter the space. We've been talking about the institutions that are entering the space. But all of a sudden, it's becoming real. Like 2 years ago on your show, Gareth, we were saying, well, you know, crypto is coming to the masses. It's going mainstream. Like it's mainstream. It's there. Well, like you can pay for nearly everything using crypto.
There's no doubt that the upside is still to come. I mean, I think that even the least optimistic people are now much less skeptical about what might happen in cryptocurrencies than they may have been before. And I'll tell you something. It's one way to, and we discussed this months ago and we haven't brought it up since, it's one way to make sure that you are not subject to the vagaries of international governments, international money flows, banks, large corporations, because really this stuff acts and operates outside of that whole world. And it is one way to make sure, if you are in a country where they're playing with the taxes, where they're playing with you know, regulations and corporations, that you can make sure your money stays more or less inert. And normally doesn't just stay inert, it normally goes up.
Yeah, well, I think one of the points to note as well is, remember, in 2010, the Rand was at 6.80 to the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
Today, what's it, about 14 Rand 70? That's still pretty good. It's actually come back from like 15.50.
Yeah.
But that's the Rand versus the dollar. If you're looking at I saw this morning, you know, the JSE All Share Index is down 12% over the last decade in dollar terms. That's why every South African feels poor when they go overseas.
Yeah.
And now you're looking at the US. I mean, beyond Biden's little tax policy massive tax policy that he's implementing, they have printed so much money that I don't think anyone understands this. And it takes a very long time for that money to filter through the system.
Mm-hmm.
We've spoken about inflation on the show before. When you increase the money supply and you don't increase the number of goods or the value of goods in society, you get more expensive goods. So when you look at, let's say, the price of a car year over year, or the price of a movie ticket, or the price of like everyday things, when they go up over time, it's actually not the price of these things going up. It's actually the currency becoming worth less, because an egg, right? Or like a movie ticket. So that's what people actually need to be fearful of now. I mean, all of a sudden you start with inflation, and I mean, South Africa, we still got moderate inflation, but if inflation starts to increase, we need to be really worried, because there's a lot of debt in the world, and that's really where the likes of Bitcoin, Litecoin, etc., like these cryptocurrencies with a fixed supply, really, you know, can provide value.
What do you think? Because I mean, when we are talking about fiscal policy, and I don't want to get too much into the reeds here, but you know, someone like Biden and his administration, with all of the money that they've printed and all the money that they're borrowing, essentially from their future, they're borrowing this from their children and their grandchildren. That account only really comes in after he's no longer president. So he's doing this without having to worry about being blamed for it, because people have short memories. And down the line, there'll be a new president in 4 years' time, and that person will get the blame.
Yeah, well, again, the dollar's the world's reserve currency right now.
Mm-hmm.
Fast forward 10 years or 15 years, you've printed all this money, you've got a lot of debt. We've actually got to sort of sit here and hope that the global economy doesn't start roaring in the way that a lot of people wanted to start roaring. If it starts to do that, interest rates increase, inflation increases, mm-hmm. and you've got a lot of debt. And remember, it's not really a problem right now because interest rates are so low that you can have tons of debt around the world and you're able to repay that. But when the interest rates increase and all of a sudden you have to be paying a lot more on that debt, you'd be like, you know, what happens then? All the dominoes start to fall.
Right.
And that's really where there's a big risk. But yeah, I agree. I mean, a four-year term, maybe an eight-year term, I suppose, best case scenario, like that's not long enough to really experience any proper cycle. You're probably experiencing either the up cycle or the down cycle during that period of time. So obviously, you know, politicians are politicians. They make decisions, you know, for short-term gain. They need to make sure that their party wins the next election. That's sort of the only game that they're playing, right?
Absolutely. All right, Sean, anything else you want to throw in before we move on?
No, I think, guys, we've said this on the show loads before. There was a big dip last week. Gareth, you asked, you know, should you go out and buy crypto? I said, yes.
I took your
obviously,
advice.
Obviously, I mean, we aligned with people wanting to buy crypto. And you've made a ton of cash, I presume. You've made, what, over 80K on that Bitcoin position, depending if you bought a whole Bitcoin or not.
Do you guys see those kinds of trends on in terms of the total number of people buying cryptocurrency? I mean, like from Revix's point of view, can you look at it and go, well, last week we saw a lot of people buying?
Definitely.
Okay.
So this is the interesting thing is as much as we say to people, look over the long term.
Yeah.
I mean, sure, you can go in and you can make 20%. You can also lose 20% over a short period of time.
Sure.
But the opportunity here isn't 2, 3, 4x. It is really 10, 15x if this market increases the way we expect it to.
Mm.
But as much as we say to people, look at the long term, they want to come in for that little short term,
sure.
you know, kind of make a million overnight sort of game. And when the market does pull back, you do see a lot of people enter the space. I mean, I can tell you right now, like I can see our revenues over a monthly basis start to tick up slightly when there's volatility in the market and people start jumping back in and all the rest. So it's not necessarily a bad thing for us.
Well, that's very, very good. Revix makes more money than the drug cartels, says Andre. Crypto is the next big drug. may that be true. May Sean be printing money.
I wish that was true. I don't think that's true, though, unfortunately.
Cindy says, oh, wow, Sean is a hottie. So I'm afraid, Cindy, the bad news is now that we're going into winter, there's where Gord comes in as well. Now that we're going into winter, Sean is highly unlikely to be appearing topless on the show. So I'm very, very sorry about that. You're going to have to live
through it. Sean, if you could just reposition your camera for the next one, because you've got like all this dead space. I understand the Revix logo is important, but we'll put it on the screen. You can just get yourself from about the nipples up. There's a good 6 to 8 inches of you that could be in shot, and it's just wasted.
All right.
So, just for the engagement value. And
we talked to Sean for Revix, not for OnlyFans, Gord. All right. Thank you.
I don't know why you talk to Sean, Gareth, but I've got my own reasons. Thank you very much.
Gord, I was going to say, when I jumped on the show, you know, there was quite an intro there. I was like, ooh, are you hitting on me?
Gord was definitely.
Yeah, you might not think so to look at me, but I'm not a very financial person. Still, I stick around.
When you guys were talking about, I can't remember what you were talking about just before the show started. I kind of joined halfway through, but it was some band, I suppose.
Yeah. We're talking about a big party that we had.
And you were sort of mentioning that, Gareth, you got their number, or does, you know, something along those lines. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Gord, you know, if I'm in your hood, you know, I'll grab your number. Maybe we'll grab a coffee.
I've already got it from Gareth, but he made me promise not to tell. He'd give it to me, so.
I did not give
it to you. I'll buy anything you sell me, mate. So bring a Bitcoin portfolio starter pack. I'm in.
Well, you don't have to know Sean personally to do that, Gord. The good news is that you can sign up to Revix for free. You verify your ID, you add funds, select the bundle of your choice, and you don't need to spend a fortune. You could put in a couple of hundred rand and start off and not be sorry about this when you start doing well. And of course, if you feel like you're taking big risks, and they've got lovely portfolios there that are rebalanced every month with all the top cryptocurrencies, but if you feel like it's not risky enough for you, you can also do other things there. And Revix gives you many different options for what you might want to invest in. And you know what? If you put in a couple of hundred rand and it doesn't work out for you, it's not going to break the bank. But if it does, you could be very, very happy this time next month. We'll see how it goes. All right. Thanks very much, Sean. Nice to see you, dude.
You got it.
Okay. Oh, sure. Cut him off before we could say goodbye properly. All right. We've got to get to blind history, which is my favorite part of the week. We are putting a lot of work and effort into these. I love doing them because for me, they are just the most, like, I learn new things every single time. It's not as if Anthony Meter and I just go into this and we unpack the knowledge we already have, little as it may be. We do research around these people. And this one for me was a really interesting one. It comes the day after Freedom Day, and we recorded it around March the 26th, March 25th, which used to be Sharpeville Day. It was a day that was very intimately linked to this man's story. He is Robert Sobukwe, and I think it's probably one of the most moving South African stories. We get a lot of emails from people saying, please, can you do more South African history? Because, you know, we don't get taught this stuff at school anymore. South African history at schools is very much oriented towards the syllabus that's been decided by the Department of Education. And you miss out on stuff. And Robert Sobukwe, not being an ANC person, he gets overlooked many times when we talk about the struggle history of South Africa. So it's
worth... he's a real legend of...
Incredible. Incredible guy. So we're going to go into blind history. This is season five, episode three. And I think you're going to enjoy this one. So, Gordo, thank you very much for being on the show this morning.
Yeah, yeah.
Always good to get an update from you.
Love you guys.
Talk to you. We'll chat to you soon. Here is Blind History, season five, episode three, Robert Sobukwe. On the 21st of March, 1960, on the dusty roads of Sharpeville, outside of Johannesburg, policemen opened fire on a crowd of peaceful protesters. 69 of them were killed. The man who organized the protests and did so much more for the advancement of human rights was known to his friends as Prof. This is the story of Robert Sobukwe. Well, it's about time in Blind History that we turn our attention to the country of our origin and birth, and that is South Africa. And it's entirely appropriate that we focus on a less well-understood, less well-known hero of South Africa's 20th century, a man called Robert Mangaliso Sobukwe. He was born, of all places, in Graaf-Reinet, and we'll tell you his story in a minute. But probably the most important facts about him that you may already know is that he was the founder of the PAC, the Pan-Africanist Congress, and he founded that with some other members of the initial grouping of that political party. And he was a South African teacher. In fact, most of the sources on the internet say teacher, and that's where they leave it. There's obviously a lot more to Robert Sobukwe, but I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Anthony Miederer. And it's good to speak to you again on Blind History. Robert Sobukwe is fascinating dude, right?
He was. I was intrigued, and it was what it came out of it for me was the South African government in its absolute worst, especially near the end of Robert Sobukwe's life.
Well, interesting in a number of ways, and people try to draw parallels between Sobukwe and Mandela, and there are some parallels. I mean, they were both tried, both sent to Robben Island. Both of them were lawyers in practice at a certain point in their lives. The big difference is that you could argue one was treated worse than the other, and you've got people who will argue that Sobukwe was treated worse than Mandela and others who will argue the opposite. But in the end, these two were both giants of the struggle and very independent thinkers, not the kind of people who you could enter an argument or a discussion or a debate with unarmed, because they were both extremely smart people and deeply, deeply concerned and passionate about their cause.
Correct, 100%. And exactly what you said, you can't convince them otherwise. I mean, Robert Sobukwe had a strongly believed in his Africanism and later on Maoism, but more importantly, that he's fundamentally Africanism. And if you weren't with the majority, then you weren't African and you didn't belong.
It was curious to read his actual writings and his philosophy and what Africanism actually is. You know, a lot of people, and growing up, I also had this very contrived idea of what the PAC was. You know, they were left of the ANC. Turns out that one of the reasons that he wanted to get out of the ANC is because he thought they were too left. And the PAC's Africanism started off with him saying there is no such thing as race. He believed we're all the human race, and that the idea of making race central to your argument is actually problematic. Now, I don't know how well that would go down with the left today, but perhaps he was prescient in that respect because he saw his role as bringing South Africa together, bringing Africa together. And he said in a beautiful quote, which I think it's inscribed on his tombstone in Graaff-Reinet, the idea that we should all rest under this tree together. And if you want to be a part of Africa, that there's nothing that stops you, provided you are happy to accept that the majority of the people must make the rules. And I think that that's probably something that many people feel is not unreasonable.
That pretty much sums up, I think, his approach. And obviously it was very much against what the apartheid government was on, and they viewed him as enemy number one.
Well, he has the distinction of having a clause that was enacted by Parliament, a statute, in fact, which was created specially for him, the Sobukwe Clause, which meant that they could broadly apply the law of keeping someone incarcerated wherever and whenever they liked without having to think about human rights or anything else. And it actually just allowed them to arbitrarily extend his imprisonment whenever they felt like it.
That was brutal because he went into prison for incitement in 1960. I think this, maybe we talk a little bit later about that. It was a massive event in South Africa, but in our history, but he went in for 2 years. That was his original sentence. And then he ended up serving 9 years. And because of this clause that you mentioned.
Yeah. Well, I think we'll start off with his early life. He was born in the middle of the Karoo in Graaff-Reinet, and he was the youngest of six kids. He came from a very poor household. His dad was very, very decidedly for education for all of his children. And they managed to get him into Heald Town, again, famously a place of many of the struggle stalwarts, one of the few places where education was available to them. And then, of course, went along the familiar route to Fort Hare University, where he actually joined the ANC Youth League all the way back in 1948. And he was actually elected the president of the Student Representative Council there. And that was really where he started to awaken politically. But he was a very studious man. And I saw a great interview with one of his friends who he was at school and at varsity with. And they said that he never had a girlfriend. He wasn't distracted. He took studying extremely seriously. He listened to Mozart. He liked to read Darwin. He was an extraordinarily academic and studious man.
Up until that point, he wasn't really interested in politics. I think it's the studies of a native administration, I think that brought him closer. And then a lot of, like you said, there was a lot of young black South Africans and black students from African countries that exposed him to politics and really piqued his interest. And I think from there, because he was an intelligent, well-read person, an extremely good orator, which he shared with Nelson Mandela, that's where he started coming to prominence.
He was also a physically prominent man. He was quite tall. He had fine features. You know, he was imposing, if nothing else. And a lot of his friends used to call him Prof. And in fact, this was a name that he kept for most of his life. They'd refer to him deferentially as Prof because he did become a professor. He became a professor at Wits University at a time where it must have been very, very difficult for a man of color to achieve that kind of role. And he continued throughout his life to read, to reason, to say only the things that he knew he really believed in that were absolutely true. But his life turned around on a day that we mark in every year, in every calendar, a day in March, which we now call Human Rights Day, a day which commemorates the Sharpeville Massacre. And Robert Sobukwe was really the man who put together a defiance campaign, which we still mark annually in South Africa as being one of the moments at which the history of the country turned and changed.
And by this point, he had founded the PAC because he was disillusioned, and maybe disillusioned is a soft word because I think it was quite a lot of internal battles within the ANC where he felt they were following a multiracial policy where he was looking at non-racial. And so by then, he had already formed the PAC and was their first president. And so it was actually, this was led by the PAC, so to speak, the Sharpeville Massacre.
It was, and obviously the Sharpeville Massacre, to those who don't know, was a watershed moment in South African history. He wanted the people of Soweto to march on the nearest police station in Orlando and to defy the pass laws. The pass laws required black Africans to present a pass anytime they were asked so by police, and they were only allowed to travel within certain hours. They weren't allowed to be out of black areas, in inverted commas, outside of those hours. And the threat of arrest was hanging over every black person's head, even if they were just trying to get home from work. Something which in a very, very dilute form, some of us have come to experience during lockdown with curfews, but it was much more brutal and militant. And they decided on peaceful protest. They wanted to march in numbers so that they couldn't all be arrested. And to make a point across the country, all the branches of the PAC had got together. And on that day, the 21st of March, they were going to march on the police stations. Of course, it didn't go very well because even though Robert Sobukwe had gone to the trouble of first resigning from Wits in a very eloquent letter in which he put his position across that he needed to follow his political instincts and lead an organization and to lead black South Africans into freedom, he also sent letters to the police saying, please, can we try our best? We are planning this protest. Let's try to keep it nonviolent. And he hoped, I think in his heart of hearts, that it wouldn't become an ugly bloodshed day. Of course, that was not to be.
So the PSC had organized in various areas, and this was in Sharpeville. In the end, 69 people were killed, and he was arrested. The government immediately banned the PSC and banned the ANC as well. And that was when he was incarcerated. But it was 100% right, Gareth, a massive turning point in the history of our country.
It was really the moment that the old government, the old regime had hoped for, because now they could prove, oh, you know, there's this danger with the black majority and we've got to impose stricter and more stringent and more brutal laws. And our past laws are definitely going to stay in place. You know, they doubled down. And he was obviously sent to jail fairly quickly. He was tried. He was found guilty of breaking a number of laws, incitement among them. Sentenced originally to only 3 years in prison. And those 3 years were served at Constitution Hill, another famous prisoner of Constitution Hill. And one of the reasons that our constitutional court is based there is because Robert Sobukwe spent his time there. And by the way, doing hard labor. It wasn't like he was just put in the cell. He had to do hard labor as a part of his sentence.
And then post that, he was moved to Robben Island, where he remained for an additional 6 years. And that was as per the clause that you'd mentioned earlier, the Sobukwe clause. So it was renewed every year, which is absolutely ludicrous. It's just, this is one of the sad parts of our history. And then
you have to imagine, because his wife Veronica has done one or two interviews. She passed away, I think, in recently 2017 or 2018 at a very advanced age. And she said a few things about him. He was a very, he was a learner. He was an academic. He was a professorial type of man. And for him to be sentenced to hard labor for those first 3 years and then to be put in the conditions that he was put in Robben Island must have been extremely difficult for him. On Robben Island, and I visited Robben Island and spent the night on Robben Island once, the single place that caught my attention as we drove past it, because at that point it wasn't even part of the museum, was Robert Sobukwe's house. It was on the route between the maximum security prison, where all the famous prisoners that we know of, including Nelson Mandela, stayed. And between that prison and the quarry where they went to work every day was Robert Sobukwe's house. And it was surrounded by fences. He lived on his own. He was not allowed contact with other prisoners. And he was isolated from them because in the eyes of the old Nationalist Party government, he was the most dangerous of all because he was also, this extraordinarily clever man. And he used to watch. He used to wake up in the morning, never really knew when his breakfast would come. It was part of the reason that, it was such torture. And he'd start his day by going out to the fence and waiting for the other prisoners to go past. He couldn't speak to them because then he'd be punished. So he would just pick up a handful of sand and let the sand fall to the ground again, kind of saying, this is our land. Don't forget, we've got to keep fighting for our land. And all the other prisoners, it was part of their ritual to kind of salute him as they walked past on their way to the quarry. But there was already a difference of opinion and a difference of politics creeping in between the ANC and PAC. And many have argued that Robert Sobukwe was treated much more unfairly because of that unbelievable isolation he was subject to. And it affected his health very, very badly.
You can just imagine spending 6 years in total isolation, no communication, although they say that he managed to at least communicate somehow with sign language.
He was allowed the occasional communication with his wife, Veronica, and his best friend, Benjamin Pogrund, who he met at Wits University and who became his biographer much later on. And I've seen interviews with Benjamin Pogrand, which are extraordinary. Very, very interesting friendship that these two built up over the years. Benjamin would send him, you know, clothes and whatever he was allowed to. He once tried to send him a carpet and they said that was not allowed. In fact, Robert Sobukwe said, no, don't make it too luxurious for me in my little house. I must remember I'm in prison. But he would ask for underwear and for socks and that kind of thing. And he was quite particular about what he would and wouldn't accept.
But he also studied.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, he got his law degree in prison.
That's right. He got a couple of degrees while he was locked up. Eventually, as I said, his health started to deteriorate. He was a smoker, a lifelong smoker. He used to smoke a pipe. Again, very professorial, you know. And I think that the government saw that they would have a problem on their hands if he died in jail. They released him into banishment, in inverted commas, in Kimberley, of all places, Khaleshewe. And he was sent there to a little house where he was allowed to stay with his wife, but he was under house arrest. He wasn't allowed to do anything political or he'd go straight back to prison. So the rules were extremely strict and he wasn't allowed political visitors, although I think he did meet with Steve Biko during that time.
But also during that time, which is another sad point, was he received offers from, I think, two in particular universities in the United States to take up posts there. And he requested that he wanted to take him and his family over there to take up these posts.
Right.
And the then Minister of Justice, John Foster, just denied permission over and over again.
Yeah, they really just would not. They were scared of this guy. It's such an expression of what an incredible person he must have been that they were so terrified of him that they wouldn't even let him speak to anybody. They wouldn't let him go overseas. You know, he must have really been the boogeyman for them.
And then he started to get sick and he needed proper treatment. But once again, around the time that he was very, very sick and needed treatment, there were such strict rules of his movement and what he can and cannot do. And without saying it led to a more premature death, I think it did play a role because he had to wait around. He had to get approval. There was a lot of red tape around him getting proper help for his cancer.
Absolutely. He died in 1977. And, you know, many people say that we missed out on one of the true intellectual heroes of the struggle and someone who was a deeply principled man. They eventually inscribed a very interesting quote on his tombstone. These are his words. True leadership, and I don't think anyone, by the way, can argue with this. This is one of those things that unless you're an ignoramus or you are willfully being destructive and stupid, can you disagree with this? Listen to this. This is beautiful. He says, true leadership demands complete subjugation of self, absolute honesty, integrity and uprightness of character, courage and fearlessness, and above all, a consuming love for one's people.
Sure, you can't argue with that.
Yeah, he was buried back in Graaf-Reinet, and luckily, one of the few things that our Department of Arts and Culture, or whoever it might be that's responsible, have done, because they're not good at keeping up history, and particularly non-ANC history, something that the PAC are very bitter about, and that they should be. They have restored his grave in Graaf-Reinet. I think they've almost made it a bit uglier, but at least someone's looking after it. He was buried in quite a simple grave. It's got a tombstone. His wife is now buried next to him. But, you know, his children live all over the world and, in fact, grew up for much of their lives in America. He sent them over there to study with the little money he had. And he was famous, by the way, for giving away lots of the money that he was meant to keep for his own, you know, use. And he never lived anything close to a grand life. He was a tremendously humble man right to the end. Someone who I wish I'd known more about, you know, he died before I was born, but I would have liked to have known more about him. I would have liked to have had the opportunity, and his voice was never recorded. His friend Benjamin Pogrand often says that he regrets the fact that he didn't record him in their few meetings that they had in Kimberley. He and his wife Anne used to go and visit Robert and Veronica. And he said he was so scared of recording him just in case that got him, Robert, into trouble. And, you know, again, we missed out on a real leader here. If you go to that little house in Robben Island, which is tiny, it's the size of probably, you know, most people's bathroom. And it was really neglected as part of the whole Robben Island exhibit for the longest time. I know that they've opened it up now. But to get the sense of complete isolation and despair that this man must have gone through during that time while he was working away trying to get these degrees. But the idea that he couldn't speak to anyone seems to me to be a punishment that is the most cruel kind for an intellectual.
Agreed, 100%.
So there he is, Robert Mangaliso Sobukwe, who died in 1977 and really has left an enduring mark on South Africa. And the PAC continues to be a party which has a very limited, but I suppose an intellectually important history in South Africa. They're obviously one of the tiniest little parties now, and that's largely as a result of what happened after Robert Sobukwe and the fact that the ANC can't claim him as their own and therefore don't go to huge trouble to emphasize his role in history. But a man who's affected the course of South Africa's story.
You know, a man in history that I'd like to learn more about now.
Yeah, I found reading about him and listening to those interviews extraordinarily interesting. So there he is, Robert Sobukwe, a South African we can be very proud of, and a man who did what he said and said what he thought, which to me has always been the definition of integrity.
Blind History is brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. All the episodes are available on the cliffcentral.com website and app, as well as Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Cliffcentral.com